For a while now, the mantra trade, not aid, has dictated how the overdeveloped countries of the global north engage with their less wealthy counterparts. The logic being that trade is more dignified than aid and leads to longer lasting change. If the poorer countries of the world would only integrate themselves thoroughly into the global trade system, they might just solve their economic problems. In contemplating the reasons why countries like Zimbabwe, which is my own country of birth, remain impoverished despite having massive amounts of natural resources, I was led to a realization that is glaring to anyone who's paying attention. The way global trade is set up may actually be one of the reasons why poor countries remain poor. The playing field is far from level, and there are multiple mechanisms that work in concert to ensure that countries cannot simply trade their way out of poverty. To try and understand how the global trade system works and to find out what can be changed, I had a series of conversations with some people who understand this stuff a little better and can explain it to me. In all these conversations, we aimed to understand how the current global trade system came to be, how it works, and how we can make it more equitable, just, and fair. Hello, and welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I'm your host, Sean Macheza. In the first of my conversations, I spoke to Grief Chelwa, an economist, about how the global trade system particularly affects African countries. Grieve, who's the director of research at the Institute on Race, Power and Politics at the New School in New York City, explained how the current setup of global trade seeks to maintain inequality and imbalances that were caused by historical circumstances. Many countries that are considered poor, upon closer inspection, turn out to be not so poor. It's just that there's something about the rules of global trade that make it so these countries remain where they are, stuck in the production of primary goods with few avenues for proper industrialization. He explained how global trade rules are currently set up makes it easy for the powerful countries of the global north to maintain their economic and all other kinds of dominance. Grieve pointed an accusatory finger at one organization in particular, the World Trade Organization. Naturally, I decided I needed to understand a little more about the World Trade Organization and how it works. Here's the WTO self-description, and I quote, "The World Trade Organization has many roles. It operates a global system of trade rules. It acts as a forum for negotiating trade agreements. It settles trade disputes between its members, and it supports the needs of developing countries." End quote. Simple and noble goals by any measure, but as it always turns out, we'll learn that the devil is in the details. I wanted to understand exactly what the World Trade Organization is, where did it come from in the first place, and why does it have the influence it has. Alexandra Strichner studied economics in Vienna and is co-founder of Attac Austria. Alexandra has decades of experience working in civil society around EU trade policy, globalization, and economic alternatives. The WTO has been the subject of a good chunk of her work, so if anyone could explain how the WTO works to me, it would have to be her. I needed to get the story from as close to the beginning as possible, so I began by asking Alexandra, what have been the main developments in global trade in the last century or so, with a specific focus on the era after the Second World War?
After World War II, there were a series of global institutions established, the Bretton Woods institutions, so the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. And historically, initially, there was also the idea of an institution to be established to govern trade, the International Trade Organization, ITO. But this one then in the end was not established because the US didn't agree. The idea was, how can we govern at a global level the economies and make sure that we don't go back to the problems that we had before? So Because the International Trade Organization in the way it was initially thought didn't come about, what was started was the so-called General Agreement in Trade and Tariffs. In short, the abbreviation is GATT. So industrialized countries, they were sitting together and said, okay, how can we govern trade relations between us? So what we export and import. And the main focus was on industrialized goods. And they discussed and agreed to reduce tariffs. So that's one of the key elements, how you govern what comes in or out of your country. You can you can sort of like manage the price, or also quotas. That's another element. You can say, I let in into my country that amount of beef or corn. So that was what was established back then after World War II. And these countries regularly then did so-called rounds of negotiations in which they continued this discussion, always with the aim to further lower tariffs or to increase quotas. And usually the rounds of negotiations, they went for a couple of years and had the name of the country in which the round of negotiations was started.
So you'd have specific rules set up, and then every number of years, these countries would come and renegotiate these rules such that everyone would then stick to the new rules as agreed at the new place.
Exactly. And one important thing in the GATT was that it was mainly on industrial goods. For agriculture, there was no agreement in that sense, but rather there was an approach to say, okay, you can produce the food in your country and you can also keep other products out that would be similar under the condition that the focus of your production on food is for your own consumption and you do not produce more and export it below the real cost of production. So, for instance, in Europe after World War II, actually the six countries that at that moment started what today is the European Union, they had a food shortage. So there was not enough food produced as compared to the demand. So there was more export coming in. But the nucleus of what is today the EU, they established also an agricultural policy with the idea to become independent of these food imports. And so that their process and their vision was to reduce that amount of imports by increasing domestic production.
So and even so as they were opening up for other goods, they were like very strict about their food supply.
Yes, exactly. Also, if you look at countries in other regions, like in African countries, people were producing the food they needed. There was not a lot of import. Actually, for a very long time, African countries have been net food exporters as compared to today, where many of these countries are net food importers. So they import more food than they export. But so that was a bit the situation back then.
What was the role of the United Nations in this? Because I would think the United Nations would have a big role to play when it comes to trade between nations. Is there a United Nations system also superimposed on this global trade?
Yeah, in that sense, the GATT as a general agreement on trade and tariffs was mainly and mostly among developed countries. Mm-hmm. So in 1964, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development was established. And that was somehow a response and an approach by the UN to say, we need also a body that particularly looks at trade investment with development focus. In that sense, this body was established to then look into how can trade and investment be organized and governed in a way that it is also beneficial to developing countries. Back then, that was the vision or the way how these countries were termed, the countries of the global south. And so that this could be supportive to development, so that trade and investment are supportive in that respect. So you had also back then in that time, for instance, when it was about investment and foreign investment coming into countries, many countries in the global south, they had rules, for instance, that they welcomed foreign investment into their countries, but always under the condition that it was linked to transfer of technology into the countries, or also linking it to local companies so that it would be not something that just comes into your country to
just displaces local industries. Yeah,
First of that, or to just come in and to extract resources and to extract wealth, as compared to how foreign direct investment is working today and how investment is governed today.
Uh-huh. So you had the general agreement as kind of governing the developed countries, mainly focusing on industrial and manufactured goods, I guess. And then you then have alongside it the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, which is now including everybody into the system. So obviously this didn't work so well, or there must have been some issues with it, because then you have the World Trade Organization that's created in 1995. What was the reason for having a WTO? Was it a bringing back the idea of the ITO that never took off at the beginning?
No, not really. I think, the WTO, the World Trade Organization, is exactly the result of one of these negotiations under the GATT. Mm-hmm. And it was the so-called Uruguay round that started in 1986. And then it took 8 years, these negotiations, until they were concluded. The outcome was then the establishment of the World Trade Organization. Uh-huh. One of the elements or conditions when the negotiations started was that at that time in the 80s, there was a real problem, for instance, in the field of agriculture and agricultural trade. The EU, but also the US, but in particular the EU, having had a policy that in the beginning was targeted to increase domestic production so that there was enough food for people living in these countries that, and of course, at that time was a bit bigger. In 86, the EU was not only the six countries, but had enlarged already. They had established an agricultural policy that led to overproduction. Uh-huh. So when there was enough food produced, because they had done and supported also a process of industrialization of agricultural production, so it had become very productive. And so the EU produced constantly more food than what was the need inside. Uh-huh. And what they did is that they started to get rid of the surplus by basically giving extra money so that it could be exported and be sold below the cost of production. So they just dumped basically this overproduction into other markets.
So they gave money to the farmers so they could sell at less than the price it took to produce the food.
Yeah, the farmers or also the traders, because usually the farmers are not necessarily the traders.
Yeah.
But so they created a system that allowed to export the milk and the tomatoes and all these things that they were producing too much. Mm-hmm. And so that they could be sold in markets outside, in particular in the global south, with a price that was so cheap that it started to create a lot of problems in these countries. Mm-hmm. Because they had enough production themselves. So they were not, for instance, for milk, it was not a problem.
They were not looking for extra milk from
elsewhere. Exactly.
And all of a sudden, you're being flooded with very cheap milk that's cheaper than what the locals are.
Exactly. Saying. And so that created a problem for the domestic production in these countries. So evidently, they were not happy about that situation. And so they wanted a solution. At the same time, there was also big agro-exporting countries in the global south, like Brazil or also Australia, New Zealand. They were so productive and they had conditions to produce so cheaply that they too were not happy with that system, because they said, hey, the EU gives all these extra money and sells at below the cost of production and is also a competition to us. So in that sense, there was a different actors that wanted a solution for that problem, because the way how under the GATT the agricultural rules were set were not functioning anymore.
So this is even with the idea that these countries, say these countries that that are suffering from too much milk coming in, they couldn't close their borders and say, we don't want EU milk, we've got enough, thank you.
Oh, they had, of course, at that time, tariffs and quotas, but still they faced that problem. And then, of course, the other agricultural exporters from the Global South and also the US, they were not happy because for them it was like, hey, wait a second, this is also our markets and you're taking away our markets. That meant that in the Uruguay round, there was a negotiation to establish a proper agreement on agriculture. Mm-hmm. The other dynamics was also that many of the manufacturers in the industrialized countries saw that their markets at home were becoming less and less interesting because, you know, there is only so much cars or so much fridges or goods that people could buy domestically. So there was also an interest in trying to get access to new markets. Mm-hmm. By lowering tariffs, by having a better system of how to organize the export. And then there was also another field that was becoming more and more important, which was the whole sector of services. So mm-hmm. if we talk about agricultural products and industrial goods, this is something we can imagine, right? There is uh-huh. something physical that you move from one country to another. It is about tariffs, it's about quotas. And then in agriculture, there was the whole issue of subsidies that was a theme, but it was physical. But uh-huh. one other thing that they started to talk about in the Uruguay round to create an agreement was services. Now, services is not something that you can move around, right? Because mm-hmm. services is something that you receive as a consumer or you give as a person. Mm-hmm. So it's
there's nothing tangible that you can say, okay, we're closing the border for exactly. this particular good. Yeah,
exactly. So in that sense, they started to discuss an agreement there. And in this field, it was very much big companies, big corporations in the field of services that had an interest to create a system that would allow them more easily to enter into a market and establish a company, or to offer cross-border a service. So back then, of course, we were still not yet in the moment of the digitalization, where now it's much more easy to even offer services across borders.
Even like remotely.
Remotely, exactly. Like today, a lot of companies let their bookkeeping do by people that sit in India, right? Or, mm-hmm. or telephonic services. But at that time, that was not yet so much the case. So there was a whole agreement negotiated around that, which is more actually an investment agreement if one nails it down, because the real hardcore thing, what the corporations in that field were interested in, and I come back to some banks, for instance, American Express, the key issue for them was so that they could enter into a market, establish a company, and be treated equally as any other domestic companies.
Mm-hmm. So regardless of the fact that they're coming in with massive capital from outside.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And in this whole field, of course, that was then one of the first big campaigns in Europe once we started to work on the World Trade Organization, was that also public services entered there, because they made a very big definition of services. So it's mm-hmm. financial services, but it's also about water services, it's telecommunication, so anything you can imagine. And there is a provision that also talks about services of general interest that we call public services, that they were negotiating in this Uruguay round, the possibility to access education as well. All these services were basically written into this agreement. And to just make a link back, so I gave a bit the historic context about agriculture and industrial goods. And I must say also in the field of agriculture, of course, there were already at that time big corporations that had been established in the different countries.
Mm-hmm.
So something that you didn't have right after World War II, when the GATT started. But in the meantime, you had Cargill and other big agricultural companies that had emerged in the US, for instance. So their vision was that they wanted to have a global market. And for a company that is operating at a global level, a transnational corporation, because at that time that already started to emerge and exist, they want to have as little transaction costs as possible. So everything that makes it more costly to produce something in one place, move it to another place, and then sell it in another place, they don't like it. So their interest was to really create a global market that has as little as possible transaction costs. Integrated companies started to emerge. So for instance, Cargill used to be a grain trader in the US and a grain producer in the US. But what emerged is that they started then to produce grain, for instance, in Latin America, and that they exported or brought to the US because that was cheap to produce there. And then they were feeding it to the big feedlots where they had a lot of cows to then produce the meat that they then were selling. So while they just would see the countries as different locations where they were doing different things.
So the supply chain becomes multinational. One product is produced there, the other ingredient is made there and in different countries. And then it's all now just one big market.
Exactly. So that was their vision already back then. And that's why they were so interested in having also this agreement on agriculture. And we know, I mean, historically, we know now, and there has been books written about and research done that in the field of agriculture, the big corporations that existed back then already, in particular in the US, but not only, they were key actors to write the agreement and the elements of it, because they wanted to make this happen in a way that how they wanted it. And the same goes for the services agreement, the GATS agreement, the General Agreement on Trade and Services. And then there was a fourth theme that was negotiated in the Uruguay round, which was an agreement on intellectual property rights. So a global agreement that would say if in a country a company gets a patent, because patents are something that are given nationally. So in each country, there is authorities where those who make an invention can go and register it. But so the idea was, how do we organize that at a global level? What are the rules governing it? And so there was an agreement negotiated, the so-called TRIPS agreement, that is governing these patents. And also there, again, it was pharmaceutical companies and other companies that had a big interest to get rules that basically would secure a very long period where the patents would be usable. So where the company that was registering the patent could say who can produce it, at what price they can produce it, and therefore also get a lot of profit out of that. That was the fourth element of what was negotiated. And the last thing that was new also was that a so-called dispute settlement was established and negotiated and then established with the WTO. So if a country does not follow the rules and the agreement that was established in the Uruguay round, then another country could come to the WTO and basically say, you are not following the rules, and now I sue you. And there would be three persons in the WTO or to look into the case. If they would say, yes, this is the case, you're right, country A, the other country is not following, then allow the country to retaliate by, for instance, increasing tariffs for certain products, or to say, no, that is not the case. So that was also new, because that was not existing with the GATT. There was no instrument to enforce, basically, the rules that were established. So basically, these things were negotiated and then concluded in 94. And the World Trade Organization with it established. So also the agreement that we want to have a formal organization that then basically makes sure that these rules are implemented and that we have continued this continuous process of further liberalization. And that was a big change, because before, the GATT was basically industrial goods with some vague rules or some elements of rules on for agriculture. And then the WTO was established and it had all these further rules that before had not been there in 95.
So this is quite fascinating. It's a lot of stuff that came in together there. once the World Trade Organization is formed, do the countries have an equal voice in the organization? You mentioned, for instance, that if one country goes to the WTO and says this country is not doing what it's supposed to do, they have the chance to retaliate. But that obviously doesn't work both ways, right? There's some countries that are more powerful than others. Did the WTO have a sort of mechanism to account for that?
It's a very interesting question you put out there, because yes, formally, one country, one voice. So in that sense, any further agreement can only come into force if all countries agree that there should be a change. So in that sense, it's one country, one voice. There is no majority rules when it is about negotiations. That's why we also have not seen any further expansion of the WTO rules so far. Mm-hmm. But as you correctly say, countries have very different possibilities. They are economically very strong or very weak. And in that sense, who is sort of like benefiting of the rules or who can influence the rules is, of course, in relation to or dependent on exactly that situation. And you can see that, for instance, with the dispute settlement unit, when you look at the cases that so far have been put forward, you can say most of the cases had been brought up by industrialized countries, the US, the EU, or by bigger countries of the global south that are also more powerful, like Brazil. But countries that are economically in very weak positions, they have not brought forward any cases. So in that sense, the use of this dispute settlement is, of course, clearly related to the question of how economically powerful a country is. But also when the idea was later on to expand the existing rules in terms of to further liberalize, you could also see that in the negotiations. I was 3 years in Geneva from 2003 to 2006 to follow the negotiations, because in 2001, there was an agreement of the ministerial conference. So what was established in the WTO is that every 2 years, ministers of all the members would meet to then discuss and continue discussions about how to further liberalize. That was the idea back then in 1995. In 1999, this idea is seeing the first time a big response of civil society in Seattle, where the negotiations in the end break down, because also a lot of people and a lot of representatives of the Global South realize that what they want doesn't have really so much place there. Yeah. But then in 2001, in the aftermath of 9/11 in Doha, where the next ministerial meeting took place, there they managed to get the agreement and start the so-called Doha development round of negotiations. And what you could see then, those of us who have started to follow and monitor the negotiations by talking in Geneva to the different representatives of the countries, you could see also how there is a complete power imbalance. You have the EU, the US, Brazil even, I mean, the big countries of the global south, they had, of course, big units, a lot of people in Geneva that would follow the different strengths of the negotiations. Whereas the smaller countries of the global south, they had very few people. And you had even countries of the global south that even didn't have
representatives.
Yeah, wow. They didn't have anybody. So the only moment that they would come and have a voice would be at the ministerial meetings.
Wow.
And so, of course, it was clear that countries with a lot of resources were dominating, would be able to steer and manage. And in that sense, the role of civil society has been very key in that moment, because what we did was that we analyzed the proposals that came in, particularly from the global north, from the EU, from the US, and tried to also give an analysis that would be useful and helpful for representatives of countries of the global south to understand, is that a good proposal? Is this really going into the direction of being in the spirit of development and basically correcting a lot of the imbalances and things that were not good with the initial agreements that came into force in 1995 or not? And in most cases, of course, many of these proposals were not good for countries of the Global South. And so there was somehow a productive cooperation and support between civil society and people that were in Geneva following the negotiations of the Global South to strengthen their capacities and positions and to engage in a conversation about where things should go and where things should not go.
So it's interesting that you have this tension between, of course, the needs of the developed countries and many of those countries in the Global South that have a little less economic power. But there seems to have been a consensus, correct me if I'm wrong, about just the need for liberalization, right? Like to say we need to open up, we need to privatize. You had a lot of countries in the Global South having their structural adjustment programs, opening themselves up to global markets. This essentially the influence of neoliberalism. Has there been a consensus always? And if not, what have been some of the tensions and what can be done about it?
I think in the 90s, there was a huge consensus about that probably. And in the sense that this was a good way to go. Of course, as you correctly say, a lot of the openings of markets in the Global South have been forced onto them via the World Bank. And then they were formalized basically through the Uruguay Round and the WTO negotiations. Because the difference is, I think, when you are doing this unilaterally because you're forced to. But the other thing is, and that is, I think, the important thing to understand, that you write it into a international agreement that is legally binding. And that is a huge difference because you cannot get out so easily anymore. And I think many countries in the Global South probably realized quickly soon after the WTO went into force that they had thought that these agreements would address problems that were out there. So in the field of agriculture, they thought because you have an agreement on agriculture that deals also with how to reduce subsidies, public subsidies that were paid by the EU or the US to their farmers and to the exporters of surplus production, that this would sort of like help them and also their possibility to export, that would give them somehow a real opportunity. So there was in the 90s, I think there was still this idea that you could trade yourself out of poverty. And I think it was even the slogan. But I think they quickly realized that that was not the case. So first of all, these agreements were really made in the interest of the big countries of the Global North and in particular also their corporations. Mm-hmm. And so they realized that this was not helpful and there were really flaws and they needed to be addressed. And of course, also, once the WTO was out there, there was more and more organizations, civil society, social movements that started to work on that or even emerge. If you take, for instance, Via Campesina, you can say Via Campesina, the peasant farmers movement is really emerging at the moment of the creation of the WTO, because many of these farmers realize and know what will happen. Mm-hmm. And they have felt trapped and not represented by the existing farmers' representations at that time. They felt like they're not defending us in the right way. So Via Campesina is emerging as a new organization and movement network. And with it also, the vision and the proposal of food sovereignty as an alternative to a global agricultural market that is liberalized, that is based on industrialized agriculture. So in that sense, right at the moment of this move in the direction of liberalizing agricultural trade, you have already this alternative emerging. And in the early 2000s, the whole work starts to also look into the General Agreement on Trade and Services, which many groups in Europe started to work on as a first entry point for them on that discussing and dealing with the World Trade Organization, mm-hmm. realizing that the projects of these big corporations that are out there already, who want to get into this whole sector of what is organized out of the profit sphere, the whole public services, they realize this is what is happening. That's what the project and the plan is. And so the first big campaigns in Europe on the WTO, on the General Agreement on Trade and Services, making this link to public services.
It's quite clear from what you've outlined that there are many things that are structurally wrong with the way world trade happens at the moment. And indeed, you've got organizations like La Via Campesina and others that are pushing back. Very quickly, what do you think an alternative world trade system looks like?
What I will say now is the fruit or the consequence also of what we have collectively been working on. So just perhaps to say that with the WTO emerges also a global network that is called Our World is Not for Sale, and regional networks where we start to collaborate and to organize in order to fight that agenda, but also to always develop and talk also about what is the alternatives. And I think one of the key elements in talking about in a more generic term is to say we need to organize trade as locally as possible and reduce the global dimension of trade to the necessary part. So today, for instance, in agriculture, we are producing and trading things in a completely stupid way because we produce apples in Europe and send them to North America where they produce them and vice versa. We destroy the chicken production in Africa when they can perfectly do themselves the production of chicken by exporting the parts that we don't eat. So we need to sort of like reduce it and organize global trade on the basis of complementarity and solidarity. I think that's another key element, because what we need is sustainable, socially well-functioning economies that are embedded in the limits of what we can produce in relation to what is possible or what is available on the earth, right? So we have a crisis of biodiversity, we have a resource crisis, we have a climate crisis. So we need to organize our economies to produce the things that we need as people, regardless where we do live. And then we need to organize global trade in complementarity and on a solidaric basis to say, okay, there is things that we might not be able to produce in certain regions. So then it makes sense. But we must move away from the vision that we need to trade as much as possible at a global level, and that would be an indicator of wealth. It isn't. So we need to bring the social, the ecological, and the economic dimension together. So it would be a stronger regionalization of the economy and trade, and a reduction of the global level. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that is clear for us that we should take out public services and probably rethink in general also the whole services part of what today is governed by the WTO. But public services should be really governed and decided by people in their respective countries and regions. It should not be part of any trade agreement. We should for sure have a particular agreement for food, for agriculture. Mm-hmm. So not have one size fit for all, because food is so essential for many people. And we could see that now again. I mean, we could see it in 2008 with the financial crisis, and now again with the COVID crisis, how quickly countries and regions come into a problem when you have trade, agriculture production and trade organized in the way we have it. So if you have not enough production in your own region and you're dependent on imports, and a country then says, well, I'm not in exporting to you anymore because I'd prefer to keep it for my people, what do the people then do there? So it must be governed in a different way. And of course, in the field of patents, and I think that is a current struggle that we can see with the COVID pandemic, where we can see again, what does it do? So we need as many production of vaccines at a cheap price so that we can have all people who want to get a vaccine to get a vaccine. And in Africa, I think the latest data is that there is only 3% of the population vaccinated. And that has to do also with exactly that system, because
those countries can produce their own vaccines due to this intellectual property.
Exactly, because it's these companies that decide on who can produce at what price. And we need to move to a system of public and common knowledge, in particular in the case of COVID. It's even more an issue because all these vaccines are out there because there was so much money, public money, that was given to get the vaccine. And so it doesn't make sense that we, as peoples, with our tax money, fund the research, and then there is a very small contribution of the big pharma to make the vaccine happen by doing the testing, and then they get all the benefits and profits, and they decide who can produce at what price. So we need to move.
Well, people are dying. people are dying.
It's incredible. It's horrible, and this is because we've created a system that serves only big corporations, whether it's pharma, whether it's agricultural corporations, or also in other sectors. And actually, there is also a body of research that came from UNCTAD that has shown that the enormous economic concentration in the hand of a few corporations in almost all sectors is a consequence of the rules that govern trade, that govern services, that have been put into place with the WTO. So there is a clear link. So we need to move away from that. And in that sense, we need trade rules that are conducive and supportive to the type of economy we need and want. So the one we need is a socially just and ecologically sound economies that produce the things we need and not profits for a few. And in that sense, we need to change them and make trade, again, something that is in function to real needs that are satisfied and not as a goal in itself. The final thing that I would like to bring in is that in these 20 years that I've been working on, there is so many incredible social movements, organizations, civil society groups, NGOs, trade unions that have come together and worked on that. And we have been growing in working together and in resisting, on the one hand, the expansion of that system, whether it's the WTO or the bilaterals, because they always try to find ways on how they can advance this vision and this expansion of trade liberalization. And there is more and more groups that are engaged in not only resisting, but in creating the alternative. I recommend and invite people to check out and see also what we are engaged in terms of creating the alternatives, and just to say, get active. We have managed to stop the expansion of the WTO. We have managed to stop other bilateral trade agreements, and we are working a lot on making the alternatives, the economic alternatives that we believe are needed, happening. Mm-hmm. And this is possible because more and more people are getting active.
Awesome. So there is hope yet.
Yes, of course. There must be always hope.
There must be always hope, for sure.
If we are not having hope that we can change things, then we are doomed. And we should get inspired by those people that have also done the big struggles before us. So the rights that we have today, this is because other people before us have been doing the same, what we are doing now, that we are living at this moment on the earth. That's our part to do that, and to not just sit there and think things are not getting in the right way or things are not good, but to say, we can change it. And the more we are, the quicker we will change it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Alexander. This is, I think,
you're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation with Alexandra Strichner, who is an economist and an activist around trade and trade policy. This was the second in a series of conversations about global trade. In upcoming episodes, we will look at how global trade, as it is currently done, contributes to climate change. We'll explore how global North countries can change the way they engage with their less wealthy counterparts. And we will zoom in on investor-state dispute settlement, ISDS. a particularly insidious mechanism that makes it difficult for countries to decouple themselves from an exploitative trade system that stifles their economic growth. It makes it difficult for them to respond to the climate emergency. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have any suggestions or questions for the podcast, reach out to us at podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today, and be sure to tune in next time.